I'm Chris Reback.
And I'm Tegan Goddard.
You're listening to the free version of Trial Balloon.
Visit trialballoon.fm to get new episodes every week and more.
Tegan, there's a question I've been trying to shoehorn into this podcast for 4 or 5 weeks now. We haven't gotten to do it. We're going to get it in today. We're going to lead with it.
Are you sure that's a good idea, Chris, just to lead with something that may be stale?
I feel good. I feel good about it. Before we get there, just a little more anticipation. We've got our mailbag reminder. If you want to send questions, you can contact Tegan via Political Wire. You can email me by simply replying to any day's newsletter. Now let's get on with the business. My question for you, which set of candidates were worse, 2016 or 2024? And here's why the timing works. We have a White House rematch. This week, we learned that President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump clinched their party's presidential nominations with decisive victories in a slate of low-profile primaries, setting up a general election rematch, Associated Press writes, that many voters do not want. There's no longer any doubt that the fall election will feature a rematch between two flawed and unpopular presidents. Their rematch, the first featuring two U.S. presidents since 1912, will almost certainly deepen the nation's searing political and cultural divides over the eight-month grind that lies ahead. Wall Street Journal added, Biden's and Trump's clinching of their nominations will mean it will be the first presidential election since 1956 that has featured a rematch. So first rematch since 56, first election featuring two U.S. presidents since 1912. So everyone else except Robert Kennedy and Aaron Rodgers are gone, Tegan, and it made me wonder, could we get in the question, which set of candidates were worse, 2016 or 2024? Before you answer, let's review the bidding of all-star lineups. Your batters in 2016 were John Kasich, Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, Ben Carson, Jeb Bush, Jim Gilmore, Chris Christie, Carly Fiorina, Rick Santorum, Rand Paul, and Mike Huckabee. Leading off 2024 were Nikki Haley, Ron DeSantis, Chris Christie, Vivek Ramaswamy, Mike Pence, Tim Scott, Doug Burgum, Asa Hutchinson, Will Hurd, and Francis Suarez. So the question to you, which set of candidates was worse?
That is an interesting thing. Now, first of all, when you're talking about candidates, you're obviously talking about the Republican fields in these 2 years in which Donald Trump managed to win the nomination both times. You could also ask this question of the general election candidates, Donald Trump versus Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump versus Joe Biden. But let's stick with the Republican lineups right now. I think on the face of it, the 2016 lineup was stronger, but the fact that they all lost to a newcomer in Donald Trump kind of makes them more pathetic in a way. Obviously, by 2024, Donald Trump is well known. He had actually changed the Republican Party over the course of those 8 years, four of which he was president. So the fact that he won the nomination this time around is, I guess, not that much of a surprise. Although, seriously, if you had gone back and asked me in 2020 that Donald Trump could win this after January 6th, I guess I would be surprised. I think on the face of it, if you're looking at the baseball cards of each of these candidates and you're turning them over, looking at their stats and their batting averages, how strong a player they were, I think the 2016 field was stronger than the 2024 field. But again, does it matter? Both sets of candidates lost to Donald Trump.
No, of course it doesn't matter, but that's not a prerequisite for this conversation, is it?
Way to lead with a question that really doesn't matter at all. I mean, could we talk about brokered conventions now?
Yeah, that's going to change my complete approach to how I prepare for these podcasts. The 2016 group obviously lasted longer. This 2024 group could not have folded faster. Nikki Haley endured a little bit, but the rest of them could not have folded faster. Does that give a little bit of an edge to 2016 as well?
I think they were stronger, except for the fact that when you think about it, you still have Nikki Haley, Ron DeSantis, Chris Christie, Mike Pence, the former vice president, Tim Scott, a very likable U.S. senator, When you think about the field this time around and the fact that they got beat by a guy who was facing 4 indictments, 91 felony charges, owes over $500 million in legal judgments, and led an insurrection at the Capitol and all the rest, the fact that those guys lost, I mean, that's kind of pathetic too. So let's just say that is not an all-star lineup as you introduced it. It's kind of pathetic.
That was misleading of me.
If it is an all-star team, then I think my grand thesis about the Republican Party is coming true before our eyes. I think the Republican Party is quickly imploding.
So maybe we attack it this way. At the World Series time, usually you go through and you're like, okay, let's compare both players at first base. Let's compare both at second base, shortstop, et cetera. So let's just go one-on-one. The two people who lasted the longest, Nikki Haley in 2024 and Ted Cruz, right? He was the last person standing in 2016. So Nikki Haley versus Ted Cruz, which one?
I think Ted Cruz was the stronger candidate. And the reason I say that is I think Ted Cruz connected with the Republican Party that was before him, where Nikki Haley appealed mostly to a lot of Democrats and independents who could vote in these early primaries and was really there more as a protest vote in the final races on Super Tuesday. But I would say Ted Cruz is the stronger candidate. I also, when you look at who's the stronger position player, you want to look at their entire career. I think Ted Cruz still has a shot at running for president again and potentially getting the nomination in the future, whereas I don't think Nikki Haley does if she continues to be a Republican.
Interesting that a guy whose wife got insulted, whose father allegedly killed JFK, who got booed off the stage at the RNC convention because he gave a speech at the RNC convention in 2016 saying not to join up with Trump, right?
He was fighting all the way to the convention and then folded like a cheap suit. So
yeah. Okay. So he was stronger. Okay. We'll do a couple more of these. Ron DeSantis versus Marco Rubio. Who's Florida man?
Those are two very weak candidates, right? There you go. That's a great example of two guys who on paper look like they should be all-stars. And Marco Rubio, literally his candidacy got destroyed by Chris Christie on that New Hampshire debate stage. I mean, just tore him apart. And then Ron DeSantis, I mean, what can I say? I'm not sure I've ever seen a more poorly run campaign than Ron DeSantis. So, wow.
How about Mike Pence, former VP, versus Jeb Bush, brother of former president?
You know, what's interesting about Mike Pence is that Mike Pence would probably never
be a sentence no one has ever stated before.
With Mike Pence, I'm not sure that anybody would have expected Mike Pence to have a strong presidential candidacy when he was simply governor of Indiana and a former congressman. But the idea that he was Trump's vice president, well, of course, former vice president, you can run for president and all the rest. But obviously that went nowhere and there was no chance in Trump's party. Is there a place for Mike Pence? But then Jeb Bush, wow, Jeb Bush's campaign, that was about as weak as can be as well.
I think you got to go Pence over Jeb.
Pence is the better candidate?
I think he was the better candidate. I mean, Jeb brought nothing. Think about all the money that got flushed with Bush.
Well, when you think about it, it's like Jeb Bush and Ron DeSantis, both Florida governors, both of them blew more than $150 million on their campaign. So I know you set the pairing with Marco Rubio, who was equally as bad, but these are some very weak candidates. If you go back to the 2016 race, don't you remember the discussion about how deep the Republican bench
was?
Yes,
incredible bench.
Turns out there's no bench. These aren't even AAA ballplayers.
Last one I got for you. Chris Christie versus Chris Christie.
I like that one the best. I have to say, Chris Christie 2024 was a lot stronger candidate. He played a role, obviously, back in 2016, and that role was essentially to take out Marco Rubio. Chris Christie really missed his chance. If he wanted to be president, he should have run in 2012 against Obama. He would have been a much stronger candidate. That was before we had Bridgegate and all of the scandals that followed him. Chris Christie 2012 was a strong candidate. But he did have a little bit of redemption. And I know you've mentioned this many times. In 2024, he had a mission, which was to try to take down Donald Trump. Now, he didn't even come close, but he did land some blows. Perhaps he weakened him. It makes me wonder, does Chris Christie have another role to play in this presidential race over the course of the next 8 months? Are we going to hear from him again? Because he's one of these Republicans who really is committed to blocking Donald Trump from the presidency.
In theory, we will have a chance to play this game again in 4 years. If we do, I promise to ask Chris Christie versus Chris Christie versus Chris Christie. As long as we do have just two candidates, although I guess RFK Jr. and Aaron Rodgers would disagree with that, I want to do a quick detour on some polls that you've posted in Political Wire. Trump holds small lead in Michigan. New Quinnipiac poll in Michigan finds Donald Trump leading Joe Biden 48-45 with 8 still undetermined. Trump ahead in Arizona. A new Fox News poll in Arizona finds Donald Trump leading Joe Biden 49-45. Trump ahead in Pennsylvania. New Emerson College The Hill poll finds Donald Trump leading Biden 47-43 with 10% still undecided. And doubling down in Pennsylvania, a new Fox News poll finds Trump ahead there 49-47. So that's 4 polls in 3 states. And yet you also posted a piece titled, "There's Plenty of Time for Biden to Catch Up." There may be plenty of time, but he's behind in so many states. Is there really time?
I absolutely think there's time. These polls, obviously, they look favorable to Trump, but keep in mind, these are polls in March of 2024. The election's not till November of 24. I come across a lot of readers who question the veracity of these polls. They may be wrong, but they also may be right. And when I say right, they're not predictive necessarily in terms of saying Donald Trump is going to win these states in November. But right now, we ask voters who's ahead, more voters are picking Donald Trump than Joe Biden. And so I actually do think that's probably correct. I do think that is the reality of our electoral landscape right now in March of 2024. But the piece that you refer to from 538's Elliot Morris is an interesting one.
The one that says there's plenty of time for Biden to catch up.
Exactly. These polls are not very predictive in terms of what's going to happen in November. The fundamentals of this race still favor Joe Biden. And the fact that we're polling people who are not necessarily engaged in politics or have not really been focused on this, like you and I are, and a lot of our listeners are, doesn't necessarily mean these are accurate snapshots of the election right now. Pretend, Chris, that you're a political consultant and you've been hired to manage the incumbent president's campaign. And this incumbent president, yes, he's 81 years old. He's got a pretty good agenda, you know, in terms of his accomplishments. He's passed a bunch of bills that have eluded Democrats for years. And he's running against a guy who has 91 felony counts against him, who has all sorts of other legal trouble related to defamation cases, civil fraud cases. You have an economy that's doing very well. I just don't see how you would think that the incumbent is the underdog in this race when you look at the fundamentals. It just doesn't make sense. And so while I don't necessarily think the polling is broken at this point, and again, it may be, but I don't necessarily think it's broken. I just think that we're polling an electorate that hasn't engaged right now. When you think about the landscape, the media landscape that we have in this world today, where everything is grabbing at our attention, you know, it's not just 3 networks with television shows that might be on at night. I mean, we are being pulled in every direction from social media to just every website on the internet, any podcast you want to listen to. You have all the music in the world at your fingertips. The idea that we're competing for voters' time and getting them to kind of focus on politics because they don't focus on politics like you and I do, I think that that's really the only flaw in the polling right now, is that you just have a population that's not really engaged in politics. They just haven't focused in on this. And if I'm that political consultant hired to run Joe Biden's campaign, and I look at who I'm running against just on paper, I'm like, wow, this is going to be an easy race.
2 thoughts come to mind. First of all, it's now, I believe, only 85 counts against him. 6 got dismissed. So maybe the threshold was 86 counts. And the fact that it's now fallen below that has made voters feel more comfortable. I think the troubling thing for Biden is that I'm assuming that these polls were done after Biden's best week in a long time, meaning that week where he had the State of the Union address, where Trump, you know, had a bunch of negative media events. You had that Katie Britt response. All of a sudden, Biden had a really good week. And if you're coming off of that really good week, I don't dismiss any of what you're saying. When you look at those fundamentals, it's still ridiculously early. There is still plenty of time for plenty to happen on both sides. There's time for Biden to do all sorts of things positively and negatively. And there's still a lot of opportunity for Trump to go off message and to say things that make various voters concerned. I guess maybe some voters less concerned. But boy, after your best week in a while, and maybe what I need to be looking at is what were the numbers in those three states just before Biden gave his State of the Union. But I would think that they would love to be coming out of his best week in weeks ahead in some of those key swing states, not still running, whatever, 2 to 4 points behind.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. The polling that I've seen has suggested there was no bounce after Biden's State of the Union address, which on one level is a little bit surprising. But again, when we talk about how Americans' attention is just splintered in so many different ways, you wonder how many people did actually engage in, is it really just the most partisan people who've already made up their minds who end up watching a State of the Union address and they kind of see what they want to see? That may be the case, but I'm not necessarily worried about those polls. But there is one big difference from 4 years ago is that Biden never trailed in the polls 4 years ago. Biden was ahead pretty much the entire race. And that is a big difference. So there's been people who say, have voters simply forgotten what it was like 4 years ago? And this last week, we celebrated the anniversary 4 years ago of the start of the pandemic. And there was a great quote by Donald Trump, which we all remember, talking about, you know, he doesn't believe it's that big a problem because if you don't measure the cases, then you don't have any cases. When you go back and you listen to that quote again, you realize, oh my goodness, this guy completely mismanaged the response of this country to the global pandemic that was upon us. And while you can excuse so much of the reaction, there were some basic things that just didn't make sense. And so much of what Donald Trump would say, particularly when he would do those 5 p.m. daily news briefings like he did for several months in a row about the response to the pandemic, he said so many ridiculous things and it was so mismanaged that I really do believe that if you reminded Americans of that and you began to show them the way it was 4 years ago and the fact that we had so many thousands of people dying every day because of this mismanagement of this pandemic to a large degree, excess deaths that we talk about because of this mismanagement, the data after the fact is pretty extraordinary. I do think that there might be this collective amnesia that Americans simply need to be reminded of what it was like. Now, if you're the Biden campaign, you come off of a great State of the Union address. What they also did was they also put $30 million into new ads into many of these swing states, essentially reminding voters exactly that, that 4 years ago was not so great. Look at what Joe Biden has done over the course of his term. So while these polls are a little bit surprising, and while the Biden campaign would like to see better polls, certainly after his best week, as you've said, again, it's still very early, and I'm not going to get totally worked up about these. I don't think Democrats are getting worked up, but obviously anybody would rather have polls that show they're ahead.
Yeah, that collective amnesia idea, and there was the Edward Luce piece, which I think is in part what you're referring to. I think you posted an excerpt from it in Political Wire. Let's put a link to that in the show notes because it really is a key idea. I actually want to spend a little bit more time with some of the ideas in that piece because if there was no bump after that State of the Union, if the whole question going in was Biden is too old, he's got no game, he can't remember anything, he's not sharp, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, everything which he acted against, behaved against in that State of the Union. If there's no bump, on the one hand, that says to me, yes, perhaps people aren't paying attention. The other thing that it says potentially is that at this point, it just doesn't matter, that everything is baked in and people's minds aren't changing. And the fact that these are the leading candidates for the last 8 years, let's say, of American politics means that people are not in a frame of mind to change their minds or to have their minds influenced. That could be extremely interesting. And that really does say to me that the battle might be over, to oversimplify it, those Nikki Haley voters, the people who are potentially looking for someplace, the ones who say they don't like any candidate and maybe they're going to sit out the election. By the way, that comment, I do not understand. I do not understand anybody saying they're going to sit out the election. I guess I can understand somebody saying they don't like either candidate. By the way, hasn't that been said every 4 years for like as long as you and I have been paying attention to politics, which at this point is 250 years, I think. But, you know, I mean, it's always that way. So I have very little sympathy for that point of view. I don't understand the sentiment that I just hate both candidates so much, I'm not going to vote. That's silly. But I do think that's where the battle's going to be, because basically everyone feels they know both of these guys. Maybe it's just that minds are made up.
Well, you know, your point is that swing vote that you're talking about, whether you call them Nikki Haley voters or you call them the double haters, those who hate both candidates. What is interesting to me is that group is however big it is right now, but we are embarking on what is going to be an 8-month nasty campaign. The amount of negative ads that are going to be run about Joe Biden and Donald Trump for the next 8 months are just going to be incredible. And so I would expect that swing group there that we talk about, the double haters, that group's going to grow over the next 8 months, that you're going to have a lot more people who are just disgusted with the whole idea. I guess the challenge is to win over those double haters is to say that you're the least objectionable of the candidates before they choose that other option, which is to not vote.
Well, then why don't we close out, Tegan, by talking about one other area, either of potential additional voters or a place where possibly voters might go. And of course, I'm speaking here of the two people that I just can't keep mentioning enough in this conversation, RFK Jr. and Aaron Rodgers. And of course, for anyone who missed it, I'm joking a little bit on Aaron Rodgers, the New York Jets, former Green Bay Packers quarterback, who allegedly Robert Kennedy reached out to about potentially running as vice president. It's launched some pieces around, can someone play in the NFL and also run for vice president? Would that sort of thing be possible? Which of course also needs to generate secondary tier articles around whether playing for the New York Jets actually qualifies as playing in the NFL, but that's for a different podcast. There was an article that you posted, why RFK Jr. should hurt Trump more than Biden. Jonathan Last wrote, if Kennedy's on the ballot, then everyone is going to find out exactly who he is and what he stands for, and they're not going to like it. If, when Kennedy's anti-vaccine beliefs are tied totally to his brand name, then that plus 11 favorability number will head south. But it won't go to zero. He'll still have supporters. It's just that these supporters will be overwhelmingly Republican, because in the era of Trump anti-vax sentiment concentrated in the GOP and within the Republican Party, vaccine skepticism is not evenly distributed. It's concentrated among self-identified MAGA Republicans. Put this all together, and I suspect that over time, RFK's support will drop by more than 66% as his favorability number collapses. His remaining support will be disproportionately drawn from low-propensity, vaccine-skeptical MAGA Republicans. The net effect of his candidacy will be a slight drag on Trump's number. Meanwhile, you also posted, Democrats go to war against third-party candidates. The DNC is building its first ever team to counter third-party and independent presidential candidates, people told NBC News, as the party and its allies prepare for a potential all-out war on candidates they view as spoilers. The DNC has hired veteran Democratic operative Liz Smith, best known for her work guiding the 2020 presidential campaign of Pete Buttigieg, to help oversee an aggressive communications component of the anti-third-party strategy, which also includes opposition research and legal challenges. My questions to you, one, does RFK Jr. matter? And if so, do you agree he stands to hurt Trump more than Biden?
It's a great question, and one that obviously the Democrats with this new effort against third-party candidates are taking seriously. The problem with RFK Jr. is the fact that he's a Kennedy, and the Kennedy name is magic in politics, particularly among those who are not paying attention. And they hear Kennedy on the ballot and they think of the Kennedy family and what was good about the Kennedy family and what they admired about the Kennedy family. And they think that RFK Jr. is that. What they don't know is that many of RFK Jr.'s siblings and cousins are not supporting his campaign. They think he's kind of crazy and would urge more voters to vote for Joe Biden. So when you see these polls that include Kennedy on the ballot, he's getting 10, 15% in many of these polls right now. He's not going to get that much as a third-party candidate. You know, Ross Perot, we remember back in 1992, got 19% of the popular vote nationally. It is unlikely that someone like RFK Jr. is going to get that level of support. And I think that Jonathan Last makes a really great point that his positive polling numbers right now are more due to his name than anything else. But what's going to happen is that the Biden campaign and possibly the Trump campaign as well are going to have to start pummeling him. And so while the Biden campaign will try to play this game where they will paint him more as a MAGA Republican, hoping that he might draw some of the people who are unhappy with Donald Trump, the Trump campaign is going to do the exact same thing, but in reverse. They're going to paint him as a liberal, as a Kennedy liberal, like his uncle Ted Kennedy or something like that. And they're going to try to paint him as a different candidate. So his favorability numbers may go south, but it's not entirely clear what the impact of this campaign will have on him. So I think it's a little bit too early to say that he will hurt Trump more than Biden. He is going to be a factor in this race, particularly if it's as close as we believe it's going to be. I do think that Kennedy will be a factor.
So you think RFK Jr. stays in?
You know, he's not necessarily going to get on every ballot, which really makes him a spoiler by definition, because he has no chance of ever getting the electoral votes he needs if he's not on all 50 states. But he has made overtures to the Libertarian Party, and the Libertarians like his anti-vax positions, I guess. There's some appeal there, but they don't like a lot of his other positions. So it'll be very interesting to see where he ends up. If he is a Libertarian candidate and Libertarians can help him get on more ballots, then he might actually be more of a factor in this election. But it remains to be seen how many ballots or even in which states. Obviously, at the end of the day, there's probably 6 or 7 swing states that matter. And those are really the states that we need to focus on. But perhaps if he had strong support in another state, he could end up expanding the map for these candidates. But we'll see. It's a long way between now and then. And his candidacy is very flawed in so many ways. But I will say he does have an ability to raise money, which I think is different than the other third party candidates, Jill Stein or Cornel West. Or, you know, Chris, the one we have to mention is this possible No Labels candidacy, because No Labels is supposedly moving forward. So we'll see. But the Democrats are obviously going to war against the third party candidates because they know that either one of them or all of them in combination could swing this race.
The No Labels candidate who has no name?
The No Name, No Labels candidate. Yeah. That would be actually it. Maybe it would be none of the above. Maybe that'll be the name.
Well, if nothing else, that would be surprising. Talk to you next week, Tegan.
See you, Chris.